Hey everybody, welcome back to the Cave of Solitude. Just a quick editor's note before we begin the show. This episode has a couple of technical difficulties just in regards to connection of me and my guest, John Rhett Thomas, being able to hear each other, but all the audio is clear. You hear the full conversation, so bear with us. Enjoy the show. Episode 199. Now. Welcome back, everybody, to the Cave of Solitude, your pop culture and comic book podcast, coming to you from the megacity metropolis of Toronto. I'm your host, Eric Anthony, and this is episode 199. For this special episode, I'm very, very happy to have in the cave for the first time ever the one and only John Rhett Thomas, also known more famously possibly as Gormu on the Marvel Masterworks website. John, thank you for coming to the show. I really appreciate it. How are you?
I am doing well, thank you. I hope you're doing well in the Cave of Solitude, which is like the right place to be in this time period that we're living in right now, Cave of Solitude.
It's the only time where that name actually made sense. So many people, I've spoken to a couple of creators, and like, why Solitude? Aren't you lonely? And it's a long story, but Ron Friends had a good laugh about that one. But it was a combination of the Batcave and Fortress of Solitude, and I'm ready to change it, I think.
Hey, it works right now, man. I'm like, dude, I'm all about solitude right now. I'm all about isolation, and so I'm cool with this socially distant podcast we're doing,
right?
So
it works out for the time that we're living in. How is it where you are? You're in Florida, right? Am I correct?
I'm in Florida, yeah. And yeah, it's fine, actually. Florida has been faring relatively well compared to the rest of the rest of the U.S., most of the rest of the U.S., we're doing okay. That doesn't mean that we're letting our guard down. I'm certainly not with the people in my life. Right. We're just being very careful and very cautious. And Florida has not suffered severe consequences yet. So, and hopefully that stays the same. So we'll see.
Right. I think for us, people like us, like the comic book geeks, a part of us enjoys that lonely time. Like, we can cope okay with a book and some quiet ambient music, but are you going a little stir crazy at all with all of this?
Well,
are you able to cope?
You know, I was just talking with a friend of mine about that earlier. She is sort of going a little stir crazy, and I'm like, I'm sort of cut out for this, I'm like, part of me doesn't like having my liberties curtailed. I like to be able to pick up and go and do whatever I want, whenever I want. And that part kind of sucks. But as far as the daily grind of staying in place and, taking care of business in your immediate vicinity, I'm like very well cut out for that.
Yeah.
So I've been tolerating that very well.
Yeah, so. I didn't mind it so much myself. What have you been doing to pass the time? Any good Marvel Masterworks or books that you've been reading?
Well, I am a workaholic, so okay. I have too much work to do when times are normal, and so I've been able to actually catch up on a lot of work. Multiple projects I'm working on, whether it's for Marvel or for my website, which I've invested a lot of time into recently, and various other projects that I'm working on. I've put a lot of time into that. I have been, I have been doing some reading. I am reading the Submariner Masterworks Volume 1. That's what I'm reading right now. Plus, I'm also reading the X-Force series from last year, the one that Ed Brisson and Dylan Burnett illustrated it, and I've started reading that. So those are the two things on my reading pile right now.
So you're like myself, where I love reading all of the classic material as well as trying to keep up with everything recent. It can be quite a chore. How is that Namor, the Masterworks, reading? Does it? I know
it's good.
Yeah,
it's good. It's 65, 66. It's from when Gene Colan was going by the pseudonym of Adam Austin. And so he was like just breaking in with Marvel and was, you know, forced to work under an assumed name. And, you know, his work's a little inconsistent early on. He has a bunch of different inkers. It was kind of neat to see Bill Everett ink him for one issue, because Bill Everett, of course, created the Submariner and still had a lot of artistic vitality to him. And it was neat to see him sort of delineate Submariner. The Vince Coletta stuff was not as great. The stories are pretty cool. Stan Lee, there's a couple issues that Stan wrote them all, of course. And there's a couple issues that really stand out as really exceptional as far as, you know, the kind of emotional emphasis behind, you know, Stan's depiction of Namor. Just some really, really good stuff. Kind of like what was going on in Thor, you know, this sort of regal, you know, bearing of Submariner and how does he respond when things aren't going his way. There's one issue that I just read, actually, is just they're from Tales of to Astonish, so they're only 12-page stories. Uh-huh. And so there's one issue which 8 of the 12 pages is just Namor just having this childish tantrum, you know? But it's great because it's like Stan's dialogue is so deep and so Shakespearean and so wonderful. It's pretty great. Yeah. So I'm enjoying it. I really enjoy reading, you know, comics from, you know, the Golden Age, the Silver Age, and the Bronze Age. That's my sweet spot. All that stuff. I love it.
Yeah, there's a lot of gold there. I mean, some people can't get into it because of the way things were formatted or written and heavy dialogue. But when you can put yourself back into that time and kind of capture what was happening in the world and you know, just put yourself in that position for a bit.
Yeah, exactly.
And be that kid, that 12-year-old kid that was reading that. You can see, like, sometimes I'll go back and read some of the that bombastic X-Men era from the late 80s into the early 90s, where sometimes people unfairly criticize it. But when you see what they were writing about and some of the things that they were referencing, you realize, like, well, no wonder the kids of today or the adults of today feel strongly about some of the things they feel strongly about when these were some of the stories that were being introduced to them. So it kind of makes the world make sense a little bit in a weird way.
Absolutely.
By reading comics.
No, I completely concur. Completely. Yeah. You know, the sort of the trends, you can spot some of the pop culture trends.
Yeah.
Precede the sort of political change that we see, you know. There's a saying, you know, politics comes downstream of the culture, and so, you know, you see things manifest in our cultural artifacts like comic books.
Yeah.
And then you look in the history books, and 5-10 years later, stuff is starting to actually happen that reflects those values. And, you know, it's part of the audience. It has consumed that material and then grown up and become voting adults.
So it's true.
You know, for better and or worse, you know.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah. So it's pretty cool. I'm enjoying Submariner. I'm reading it from the softcover Masterworks version, which was the best reproduced version of that material. So,
oh, okay.
In case anybody listening is wondering, which is he reading it in the hardcover Masterworks? What's he reading it?
There's definitely someone wondering that for sure.
Yeah.
We're sticklers for those little details that no one seems to understand. Like, why does that even matter? Who cares?
Exactly. So, in Submariner's case, it's like if you're reading the 2002 version or the 2004 version, there's a huge difference in quality.
Right.
The 2002 version was sort of like not as good. They weren't working from as good files. And then the 2004 version, they did it from the ground up and got a lot of actually, let me dial that back. Let me correct all that. It's the softcover version from 2000. When did that come out? 2009, 2010, where they, you know, were able to pull from the film, the original film or photostats that Marvel had on hand to reproduce the material from. And whatever, you know, Corey Settlemyer, the editor of the books, is able to, you know, get even better materials from private collectors, whether it's original art that he can scan from or whatever. And so that book, the softcover version of that Masterworks, is the best version for quality. So I'm reading from that one.
Yeah. See, we completely understand that language. I just wish my wife would understand that as well as we do. I have to buy this new version or I have to get that one. You don't understand.
Right.
So you've become pretty well known as a comic book historian in many ways, cataloging a lot of the masterworks, doing some of the freelance work that you're doing now for Marvel. What's your personal comic book history, though? I want to get into that. Take me back to when you were a kid.
First, I got to correct you. I am in no way a historian.
You're a historian.
I like the word catalog. That sort of, I'm sort of like an organizer or a cataloger of the work of many other people.
A curator? Is a curator a better word?
Sure, I curate material for the books I work on. How about that? That sounds good. But I don't want us to lay claim to being a historian.
Okay.
I'm young. I wasn't around when these comics were first published. You know, people like Roy Thomas, you know, Jerry Bales, who they started, you know, Alter Ego in their childhood years. Those guys are the historians. You know, Mike Vassallo, Barry Pearl, Nick Caputo. Any of those guys whose names you see in the credits of Masterworks for, like, you know, art identification and things like that. Mark Evanier, the News From Me guy, that guy's like, you know, hardcore comic book historian. They have the knowledge, and I read all that stuff and I learn from it. And I've been around the block enough to kind of be able to put two and two together. But, you know, I'm not. Except in the case of, like, the Stan Lee book that I worked on with Tasha and maybe a few other projects, I haven't actually, like, gone into the archives and pulled out the Dead Sea Scrolls and started, you know, and started reading them and interpreting them and stuff like that, you know. So I don't want to say that I'm a historian, but I do know enough about all the moving parts of this industry to sort of be able to put material together and present it in a way that, certainly in the art books that I work on, hopefully makes sense for people, you know. So that's sort of who I am today. As far as did you kind of want to know when I started reading comics and all that?
Yeah, when did you fall in love with it? When did you know this is something, this is a language that I can understand and that I love?
Well, I have a really bad memory, like Stan Lee. I have a bad memory. But I have major, major glimmers of moments from the past. Mm-hmm. So, like, I remember a time when I went to the hospital to visit someone when I was a little kid, like I was 8. And I went into the gift store, and I remember Tales to Astonish reprints with Submariner, ironically enough that I had just mentioned him previously. And that was in 1979, I think. And I remember buying that and just being entranced by it. And then I remember being in grade school, so like third, fourth, fifth grade, and there was a popular line of notebooks that were called, I think, Duo Tang was the brand name. in the 70s, and they licensed from Marvel, you know, actual comic book covers and interior panels of the comics. So I remember seeing kids coming in and they had Captain America, the Mad Bomb cover by Jack Kirby, Captain America and the Falcon. And then there was a Thor one. And then, the Fantastic Four issue, number 159 with the Inhumans on the cover. And I was just like blown away by this art. I was like, oh my God, this is like so great. But in the mid late 70s, I grew up in a small town. There was no way to actually get comic books, but they were sort of on my radar, and I kind of knew what they were, and I kind of coveted them. And so, like, I think my cousins found out about it, and they were getting a little too old to read comics, and so they donated all their comics to me. And so I remember my mom brought over this big black trash bag full of comics. And they're stacked comics, and there were some Champions in there. I remember the Champions by John Byrne were in there. Some Guardians of the Galaxy, the Marvel Presents series. What else was in that bag? There were so many cool comics in that bag, and I just read all that stuff. So those were sort of like the main instigators for my love of comics. And then, and I think fifth grade, so I would have been like 11 or 10. This classmate of mine showed up to school. He was a new kid in school, and he was weird. He was weird because he had like long hair, and then like he was like a hippie kid, and that was really weird. Nobody had ever seen a hippie kid before, and a lot of kids were making fun of him for that. And it just so happened that one of the teachers asked me and another student to kind of show him around the campus, and so we did. And I was nice to him. I liked him enough. And, you know, I was definitely like, he has long hair, this is weird. But at the same time, I wasn't like mean to him or anything. So showed him around school, and then a couple days went by, and I ran into him by the bike racks, and he was about to ride home, and he opened up his backpack and he says, "Hey man, you might want to see some of this." And he pulled out a big stack of comics, and it was all the mid-70s, late-70s Jack Kirby comics from Marvel. So you've got Machine Man and Black Panther and Captain America and Eternals. He had like, he was a Jack Kirby freak at that time. And that's the stuff I had seen. I'd seen that Mad Bomb cover, Captain America, on that folder. And also that Fantastic Four cover with the Inhumans, while that was not drawn by Kirby, it was Rich Buckler doing Kirby. So Kirby really spoke to me. And he's like, "I'll let you borrow these if you want." I said, "Hell yeah." So I took this big stack of comics out, and I remembered some of them were so well read that he had used duct tape to bind them.
The good old days.
Yeah, the good old days when nobody really cared about this kind of stuff. And I read the hell out of that stack of comics, and that's how I fell in love with Machine Man and the Eternals and stuff. Those were some of my first comics. And so that sort of ignited my just passion. And my mom started to figure things out and was like encouraging me to actually read them. And she figured out where to actually get some. And so she would take me to this used bookstore that sold them. And then from there, you know, I started saving up money and mowing lawns and fishing, doing stuff like, I was a commercial fisherman as a kid with my dad. And so I'd save up money from all that, and I would buy comic books. And so there was a gas station too in town that sold comics on a spinner rack. And so I started to sort of buy off of that spinner rack too. So, and I'm probably leaving out some other, you know, milestone moments. But those are some, that's sort of like what got me started.
Well, I have to, first of all, disagree with you, because you said you have not a great memory. That sounds like a pretty good memory, because there's some
well, real I have a well-rounded memory about those moments. Yeah. But there's other things.
That's all like, that matters.
For instance, I remember the first comic book store I went to in Melbourne, Florida, but I can't remember for the life of me remember the name of it. I don't remember the name of it. But I went there all the time, so can't remember the name of the comic book store.
That's okay, but the memory is still pretty sharp, I got to say. What was it about Jack Kirby? Because I've heard you talk about
him
before.
I think I'm losing you, though. What's that?
Can you hear me? Am I coming through? Hello?
I can hear you now, I think.
Okay, all right.
Yes, I can hear you now. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can. I was saying, what was it about Jack Kirby's art that spoke to you? Because a lot of people often say when they were young, Jack Kirby was blocky. It was, you know, his art was ugly. Later on, when they become a little bit more well-rounded and their comic book knowledge becomes a little more sophisticated, we start to see that everybody is doing a version of Jack Kirby, even if you think they're not. Like, whether you think you like Jack Kirby or not, you like Jack Kirby. So what was it for you that you were just a Kirby freak?
Well, I think Kirby's style is everything you said it was. All the derogatory things said about his style is a valid criticism. You know, in the late 70s, his art was sort of, you know, it was diminishing a little bit compared to what it was in the 60s, certainly, in the late 50s. You know, he was getting older and, you know, he was turning out a lot more pages and, you know, his work was suffering a little bit, but I didn't notice. To me, it was like tabula rasa. It was like the new thing. It was my first experience with his artwork. And so I responded to it immediately. I loved the big wide open mouths and the blocky, you know, figures and the explosive power in his layouts. you know, the violence in his work. Even like, you know, most kids are like, my favorite character is Batman and Spider-Man. My favorite character in the late '70s was like Machine Man, but also I was a big fan of Eternals. So like the drama and the issues with, Carcass, remember Carcass, the big red giant deviant. Okay. He was one of my favorite characters because Kirby imbued him with such emotion and such drama and agony. It was like I felt every bad thing that happened to poor Carcass in those issues he was in, and it was like it had me on the edge of my seat. I just loved it so much that, you know, to me it was like perfect comic books, you know. It was the best. And so I don't know. And also Kirby's work in that period of time, certainly with the Eternals, but also like Machine Man, has this real sci-fi angle to it. And so did his Captain America. Kirby was really into the mid to late 70s preoccupation in pop culture with, like, you know, aliens from outer space, the aliens in antiquity, you know, the chariots of the gods, kind of stuff of like alternate histories and, you know, that the human race may be descended from aliens. I don't think Jack believed that, don't get me wrong, but he used that material to inform his work in a way that I thought was really appealing. And I was like In Search Of with Leonard Nimoy, to me, was must-see TV. I watched that every new episode. Any of those specials on the Chariots of the Gods and stuff, I was really into. Anything dealing with UFOs, I was into. And, you know, Jack was into that as well. He saw what was going on around him in pop culture and was like, well, I'll try some of that too, you know. And so he had Captain America having fighting UFO aliens, you know, and stuff like that. It was to me, it was cool. So that sort of, I guess that's why that material spoke to me as well.
Yeah, it aligned up perfectly with the timing of everything. I gotta say, like, when I read some of the things that Jack Kirby inspired, whether it's you know, Thor's world with the realms and what he ended up doing with DC, a lot of those alternate histories that you're referring
to. Hey, Eric. Yeah, I lost you.
Oh, okay. I'm gonna check and see if my battery is dying on my speaker here. Can you hear me?
Okay.
Okay.
I can hear you perfect now, but for the last 15 seconds, I couldn't.
Okay. What I was saying was, when it comes to Kirby's history that you were referring to, there is something special about that imagination that was going on in his brain. And for when I'm reading, whether it's the New Gods or things from Thor, or even like you said with the Eternal and the Celestials and all of that stuff, there's something about it that just, I don't know, it touches a part of my mind that it makes sense, but I don't understand it at all, if that makes any sense.
Right. Oh yeah, sure. Kirby's Eternals especially was just rambling. It never resolved itself. It just sort of, you know, it kept introducing new ideas and new characters and never really giving you a satisfying send off for any of that stuff. But to me, you know, let's be real, there's so many comic books that we can pull off the shelf, and if you want a well-told, compact story, there is limitless options for that, you know. But if you want Jack Kirby, you've got that too. Right. And Jack Kirby's material in that period, where he was writing his own stuff, is so unique that it is all unto itself. His late period Marvel stuff, and DC, fold that into it as well, the New Gods material, although I didn't read that until I was much older. That stuff is so weird and so wacky. It's so one of a kind that that reason alone to love it. You know, it's just, experience it for what it is. Don't ask for it something that it can't give you. It's not going to give you this perfectly executed story with all this great dialogue. But what it will give you is something very special and very unique. And if you're into that, if you let it be what it is, then you can really enjoy it, I think.
Yeah, you know? I've never.
You just have to sort of reset your expectations a little bit.
Yeah, I've never read his his eternal stuff, only what other people worked on after the fact. And I see that it's going to be getting released in omnibus form and complete collection. So I'm tempted to delve into it. But like you said, there's that aspect of what we're used to as far as dialoguing and as far as getting complete stories. So I wonder how it'll sit with me. But just the design work and all of the places he takes you to, it's incredible. Like, I can't help but look at it. So that'll be interesting. Yeah. I know you're pretty excited about the Eternals coming out, so I'm happy that you're getting that collection finally of it all.
Yeah, if I may promote my website, I've got a very thorough preview page for the Eternals omnibus. It has art from everything. It has the Kirby stuff, the '80s series by Peter Gillis and Sal Buscema and Walter Simonson. It has stuff from all the other material compiled. So if you want to go look at what's in the book and sort of get a taste for it, that is a place to go. But I will say that, I think Marvel just released the first issue of the Eternals in one of their, reproduction issues. And so you might want to try that to get your feet wet in the Eternals.
Okay.
So.
Sounds good. What's the website again? I don't know if you mentioned it.
It's collectededitions.com.
Okay, perfect.
Formerly known as marvelmasterworks.com. And I've done a soft launch of my new website concept. Okay. I haven't really been talking about it a lot, and there's some things I'm going to be doing to really promote it big time. But for now, I'm sort of still in the content building, framework building side of things. And but soon, it'll be much bigger and much better. But for now, I do have that Eternals page up there in the library section of the site. So
awesome. All right. So be sure to check that out, everybody. Collectededitions.com. I actually went to that site, and it's coming along nicely. Every time I visit it, you can see that it's continuing to grow. So that's good.
Yeah. Well, right now it's just all this Masterworks content that I'm carrying over from the old site. But one thing I do want to make sure people know about is the release schedule that everybody loves so much is still being maintained, and it's current. And there's a tab there. There's a link on the main page for release schedule. And if you click on that link, it'll have everything you could possibly want to know about upcoming books and when they're released. And we keep that stuff super current. So,
I think collectors love doing that stuff as much as we love reading the content. We love looking up when things are coming out and what's mapped out for the next couple of months or what's in the next year. So it'll be a nice resource to have for sure. Yes. Everybody has their story of when they left comics for a little bit and then getting back into comics. Did that happen to you as well?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Basically, in the waning years of high school, I was reading comics less and less. Mm-hmm. And then when I went to college in 1989, I shut the door on it completely. I have a great appreciation for what was going on in the art world at the time now, but back then I really wasn't into the kind of Rob Liefeld stuff, and that kind of stuff was a real turnoff. I actually have quite an affinity for Rob Liefeld now. I just think, like Kirby, he's his own thing, man. He has a life all his own, and I kind of dig it now for what it is. I really enjoy some of his stuff. But that's one of the reasons why. Plus, I was I had no money. I was totally broke as a college student, and I did keep up with one comic, and that was Sandman. And that's the only comic I continued with. But I did, it's funny, even though I turned my back on comics, buying new comics, I took my Masterworks with me to college. I had a collection of about 10 of them, 10 to 12 maybe. And I kept them on my bookshelf next to all my my literature books, because I was an English major, so I had all the, all the great works of literature. And I kept my Masterworks on there right next to them. So I still sort of hung on to that part of my life. Whenever I wanted to kind of look at comics, I'd pull that off the shelf and take a look at it. But it wasn't until 1999, 2000, so about 10 years, that I got back into comics. So for about a full 10 years, I was completely out. The whole 90s, pretty much, I was checked out.
What brought you back?
Well, I was two things. One, my best friend, who also helps me on the collectededitions.com website, Dum Dum Dugan, had started reading comics again. Mm. Unbeknownst to me, when we were high school buddies, we were both reading comics, but we didn't know it. We didn't share that information with each other.
That's so funny.
And then he started reading again, and I went over to visit him one day, and I saw this stack of comics, and he had the Kurt Busiek, George Perez Avengers. Mm. He had the Christopher Priest Black Panther. He had, what else did he have? I think that was it. Those two comics. And he says, I asked him, I said, are these any good? And he's like, yeah, they're good. You should give it a shot. I said, well, I don't really like comics anymore. they're not for me anymore. You know, he's like, well, you should really try these and see what you think. And so I borrowed them and I read them and I liked them. I was like, wow, this is something else. You know, Priest Black Panther was like really good.
Yeah.
Really sophisticated storytelling. And I didn't feel like, you know, I felt like, you know, this is for me. And so, simultaneous to that, I had started to think about, I wasn't quite sure what to do with my masterworks or a lot of things in my life. I was looking to declutter, and eBay was really huge at the time. It was like, had just started, and I went on eBay and I typed in masterworks, and my eyes were boggled by the prices these books were going for. And I was like, damn, I was like, I've got to sell these books. I could make a fortune on these these books.
Right.
So I started doing research to sell them, and I started reading them again and falling back in love with them. And I was like, I can't sell these. I love them too much. And in doing the research to sell them, I actually started doing the research to buy the ones I didn't have. So
that's hilarious.
So that's, yeah, that's sort of like what happened to me with that. And so there you go.
Yeah,
those two things happened at about the same time, and then I was like back to being a comic book fan. I remember going to the comic book store, Comics Plus in Macon, Georgia, and I said, you're gonna get five comics. You're gonna get on a pull list for five comics, and I got Black Panther, Avengers. I got the Iron Man series, and what other two comics did I get? I forget. Defenders. At the time, Defenders had come out by Eric Larson and Kurt Busiek. I got Defenders, and one other comic. I got five comics.
Thunderbolts,
maybe? And
then I ordered
collected editions. I got those as well. So.
Okay. Was Thunderbolts on that list? Because that was another
Thunderbolts. Yes, Thunderbolts. My buddy Dugan put me onto Thunderbolts.
Okay, so from the sounds of it,
how did you pull that out of the hat? That's exactly right.
I'm looking at my shelf, and yeah. I'm looking at all the ones you listed, and I said, okay, there's one.
I think I lost you again there.
Oh, am I there? Hello.
I can hear you now. Yeah, okay. So start over with your idea.
I was just thinking of the time period, and there was a through line. Other than the Christopher Priest, you had an affinity for Kurt Busiek, which I do as well. And all of those titles that you mentioned are some of my favorite from that time too. That Heroes Reborn or Heroes Return era was great stuff. Especially Kurt Busiek firing on all cylinders. Like, he was the man at that time.
Yeah, that was the perfect time for someone like me. It was like the right time, right place to get back into comics, with someone like him sort of helping me make that transition. And by the time I was in comics fully, I started to look around and see that there was so much other good material being published. You know, I was, you know, the 180-degree opposite of the Busiek Perez stuff was what Milligan and Allred were doing with X-Force. And I was like, loved X-Force so much. So, you know, I was like exploring all different kinds of cool new comics.
Yeah,
and
awesome.
So now I've been reading ever since.
Yeah. I read all of those books myself retroactively. I was maybe a little too young at the time to be in the know of how good those comics were, and also didn't have the money. That was my high school era. But later on, when I could get the collected editions, and you just hear people wax rhapsodic about Busick and Perez Avengers and Christopher Priest Black Panther, and I couldn't help it. I had to jump down that rabbit hole, and it's great stuff. I recommend it to anybody who loves good old fashioned superhero comics. Yeah. That's the stuff.
I'm glad that the Priest collects.
Hello? Sorry, I lost you there this time.
I'm sorry, I lost you again.
This connection's not our friend tonight. You know, you were just saying.
Good.
Yeah, okay. You were just saying about the Priest collection. How happy you are that it came out.
Yeah, all that material is now in trade paperback, so that's awesome.
Is it still in print?
That's a good question. It wouldn't surprise me if some of the early volumes are sold out.
Yeah.
But I can check while we're talking. So.
Okay, perfect. So you are a historian and a curator. You're lying. So how did the website get launched? You went from wanting to sell your masterworks, you said, to wanting to now collect them all, and you became full-fledged comic book guy. So was it just the natural progression of, like, I'm so into this, I want to just keep going with this thing?
Yeah, well, around the time I was looking on eBay to sell my masterworks, and then I started to want to acquire the masterworks, I realized what a deficit of information there was about masterworks on the internet. And this is 1999, 2000. And so I'd been taking notes all along about the research I had done about masterworks. I just, simultaneous to that, it was in the back of my mind to start a website. I didn't really think about what, but to me it was kind of a novelty to have a website, just as a personal challenge to sort of, like, you know, see if I could do it. So I started a website, and I thought, well, you have all this information about the masterworks, and it's information that would be of value to people, so that would seem to be just something to do. So that's what I built my idea around, is like, make a website about the Marvel Masterworks. So that's what I did. And my first, you know, MarvelMasterworks.com 1.0 was just outlining the, at the time, 27 volumes plus the other volumes that had come out in the years since. So there were, I think, 32 volumes in the, you know, the first couple of years of my website. And then I branched out into adding a message board forum for Marvel. And then I was very active on the DC Archives forum on the DC website. But then DC sort of, like, got real, you know, managerial about their message board forum. People did not really want to be involved with that. And so I opened up a DC plank on my Masterworks forum, and I got a lot of people to come over from there. You know, so my website and message board just kind of really grew really quick, and sort of, like, put me on the map, I guess, in fandom circles. So, you know, it was kind of like, you know, Roy Thomas and Jerry Bell's publishing their own little fanzine out of their, you know, out of their garage. And the equivalent for me was starting this, you know, this website, and I made friends the world over within a very short period of time. You know, it was pretty cool.
Yeah, that's incredible. I find it so interesting how people such as yourself, and you may have been or been one of the first to really dig into the niche aspect. Can you hear me?
I can't hear you. I couldn't hear you at all, really. I heard a couple words.
Bear with us, everybody. We're going to get through this together.
Are you able to edit this?
I could edit it. It's okay. Yeah. It's all natural.
All right.
It's all good. What I was saying was, I find it so interesting how people such as yourself who dig into a niche aspect of this hobby and go that extra length to catalog or to share information about it. Like, even some other podcasts, such as the Epic Marvel podcast from Curtis Finley and the YouTube channel, like Gem Mint or Nearly Mint Conditions, where people all flock to these things to get this information, but it's just from people who specialize even in just like a niche part of the niche. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I find that absolutely so interesting. Yeah. What do you think that is about us as collectors where those things kind of take off and become a culture within it with on their own in a way?
Well, I think, and particularly with Masterworks and DC Archives, it is a niche within a niche. You know, comic books itself is a niche, mm-hmm. and collected editions of comic books is a niche within a niche. And classic comic book reprints, as opposed to, you know, the latest comics being collected, is a niche within that niche. You know, yeah. So once you drill down, there's just niches everywhere.
Yeah.
But Masterworks is so expansive because you've got, in the early years, you had the Silver Age of Marvel, which you had a lot of people were, you know, hundreds of thousands of people were avid buyers of those comics back in the day, in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah.
You know, several hundreds of thousands of people. And so now 30, 40, 50 years later, those people, whether for nostalgia or whether because they still have an active interest in comics or whatever, are now given the opportunity to experience those old comics again. It's very powerful, you know. It is a niche, but it's also a very powerful niche, and it can be a very expensive niche. You know, the prices of these books have always been the highest priced thing in the comic book industry, mm-hmm. as far as reading material. I mean, you can get into statues and limited prints and stuff like that, and then, you know, it gets really expensive. But as far as reading material, actual books, you know, these kinds of hardcover Masterworks and Archives have always been at the top end. They've got a very sophisticated customer base that kind of is also very interested in spending their money wisely. And also, you know, we're comic book fans, so we have this need for completionism. Many of us do, whether it's an artist or whether it's a series or whether it's a character. We want to know what's out there so that we have the opportunity to have all that material on our shelf. And so I think the fact that I started that website when I did, in the early years of the internet, really, as far as the popular usage of the internet has been around for much longer, but it wasn't until the late 90s that it started entering into people's homes in a meaningful way, you know?
Yeah.
I didn't have my first real email address until like 1998, 99.
Right.
I started the website in 2000. So we're, you know, this is our 20th anniversary really of me being in this position. So whether I have used my power wisely or not, I don't know, but, it's been quite a ride. It's been very fun. I've made many lifelong friends out of this experience.
Yeah.
Real, actual, you know, friendships. So it's pretty great.
It boggles my mind to think that you went from wanting to sell Masterworks, like we said before, to starting a website, to then being a part of writing a Stan Lee book or biography. Like, can you tell us about that journey a little bit? Because it kind of is a story of, I don't want to sound hyperbolic, but hope, because we all get into this hobby, whether it's podcasting or going to these cons and exchanging this sort of culture of the comic book medium, because it's a very lonely thing to do. You read these books by yourself, but there's this thing that you're able to enjoy when you find people who love it as much as you. And it took you all the way to being acquaintances or friends with Stan Lee. Like, that's pretty incredible.
Yeah, I would say acquaintance. I wish I could claim friendship, but I don't know how many friends, real legitimate friends, Stan had by the time I came into his life. But I had my website had become such a popular place, and I had become sort of a known quantity to Marvel that they kind of headhunted me to do. To sort of remember Marvel Age. I don't know if you remember that.
Yeah.
Marvel Age book from the 80s and early 90s, but they wanted to sort of redo that concept. And I think they were looking for someone who had one foot in the fan circle to do it. They didn't want to do it in-house so much as they wanted to bring somebody in who sort of understood a fan's perspective. And so they asked me to sort of put a pitch together for that. And so I ran the Marvel Spotlight book for, I think we did that for, geez, about 7 years. And in the midst of that, I sort of became reputable with the editors there to sort of take on other projects like art books. During that period of time where I was sort of building my project management acumen, I had a chance to interview Stan for a Spotlight magazine on him and Jack Kirby. And I was going to interview him, and so I was going to call him up on the phone. And no, actually, I wasn't going to call him. I was going to actually meet him. I was going to go out to LA and meet him and talk to him. I was legit scared. I was like, all the things you think about meeting your hero are going through your mind of like, is he going to be the person, you know, is he going to be that person I think he is? Is he going to be that hero I hold him up to be and all that stuff? And I remember talking to Jeff Youngquist at Marvel. He was the special projects editor at the time. And he's like, look, don't worry. He's like, Stan is going to be exactly who you think he's going to be. Don't worry. And I was like, okay. So, but I got my buddy Justin Fairfax, who lives in LA. I didn't want to experience this moment alone. I figured I'd share it with somebody else. So I got him, and he and I met up and went to Stan's office in Beverly Hills, and we had a really great 2-hour meeting with Stan, where I interviewed him for the book, and that material wound up in that Spotlight. That's the first time I met Stan. It was just perfect. It was wonderful. I'm jealous of myself for having had that experience. Then I got involved with Taschen Books. They are the German art book publisher, and they, you know, I worked on their book, Marvel 75th Anniversary book. And I did some writing in that book and some editorial work on that book. And then they did a Stan Lee book. And so I was given the editorial reins of that book, the text. Josh Baker was the art director. He handled the layout of all the artwork and all the selections. I had a little hand in that, but he was the main guy behind everything you actually see in the book. But when it, you know, the text that Roy Thomas wrote, I edited and I did some additional writing as well. Along with Jess Harold, who worked with me on Marvel Spotlight, recruited him to work on that as well. So I was living in LA for a while, and I got to work out of the PAL Entertainment office pretty up close for a while. And so I got to, for a while there, I got to, you know, hang around with Stan in his office and talk to him. And like I said, one of the great moments of my life was on the last day I was there in the office. I was getting ready to say goodbye, and Stan called me by my name. And he remembered my name, which is like, you know, Stan's memory was so terrible, but he called me Rhett, you know, and he didn't have to be reminded of my name. And that made me feel like $1 million. And, but no, just sort of seeing Stan in the office, seeing him in his element is a memory that I will cherish forever. I was up close to that and very personal with it. Stan was there every day that I was there. He came in every morning, and he would usually leave around lunch, after lunch. He would leave the office and go home. But he was in the office every day of the week from early in the morning until then. And this was when he was 92 years old. I'm hoping I'm able to keep office hours like that. And he was actively engaged in the projects he was working on. I know because I saw it. I went through his archives and went through a lot of materials you know, materials that he worked on, projects that he worked on, you know, I really have some insights into that that are very special to me. And I got to talk to the man. I got to talk to his partners in the office. It was just a wonderful experience for me, and have some very, you know, just great memories that I'll remember forever.
That's awesome. I mean, it's so refreshing when a person who is almost mythical to a lot of us who, like, people know Stan Lee now because of the movies. Hey, that's Stan Lee. He made everybody. You know, that's their connection to him. But for us, we see it as a person who kept comics alive, created an entire universe with Jack Kirby and Steve Ditko, of course. Right. And but he's become almost a mythical figure to us. And for you to meet him and for him to live up to that image that you had of him is so refreshing. Because a lot of times you meet some creators sometimes where it's like, oh, that was it.
Yeah. Catch him on a bad day.
And, yeah, you know. Exactly. It's like, well, I feel stupid now. That guy made me feel kind of dumb. But to know that Stan Lee always, every story you hear of him, people always say he was exactly who I always thought he was, which is great. Which is good. Yeah.
Yeah, Stan was the man for sure. Loved him. Genuinely loved that man.
That's good.
And, you know, people could say, people like to criticize, there's certain, a small vocal minority of people that like to criticize him. And I say, whatever. Those criticisms are almost beside the point to me. You know, the things that made Stan great are just beyond anything you can complain about where it comes to him.
Yeah, when it's all said and done at the end of it all, when you look at everything that he contributed to and the people he worked with and how he championed this medium, I mean, he's second to none, really.
Right.
So, yep. I mean, we can get into the complexities of any figure who lived as large of a life as he did, but at the end of the day, Stan Lee, like you said, he's the man. You're now working on something with Roy Thomas, so along with some of the people that we mentioned on that, you know, I can't think of the reference now, but all of those faces that you would have on a monument. Now you're working with Roy Thomas. What's
Mount
that
Rushmore.
Like? Mount Rushmore. Thank you.
You're Canadian, I know, so you don't have to know that.
I know Mount Rushmore was at the tip of my tongue, and I'm like, what is wrong with you, Eric? The Mount Rushmore of comics. Yeah, because I think unquestionably Roy Thomas and Stan Lee, as far as writers go, they're up there for sure.
I guess the Canadian equivalent of it would be the Big Nickel in Sudbury, right?
Oh, no. You know what? I'm impressed that you know that. That's real cool. But Mount Rushmore is what we refer to here whenever we make a statement of like, who's on your Mount Rushmore of such and such. Right. We still use Mount Rushmore. But thank you for the Big Nickel reference.
That's right. Well, I've actually been there. A buddy of mine and I were like planning a road trip through Canada, and we were just sort of like trying to figure out places we might go. And when we came across Sudbury, and we were like, we thought the name Sudbury was kind of funny to begin with. And then when we learned that there was this massive nickel on the top of a hill there, I was like, we got to go to Sudbury to see the Big Nickel. And so that's damn sure what we did.
That's a lot. Was it everything you wanted it to be?
It was everything we could have wanted it to be. Okay. It was so special.
Perfect. Go ahead.
So were you going to ask me who's on my Mount Rushmore of comics?
No, I was saying now you're working with Roy Thomas, who's on, besides Stan, when it comes to writers and editors, especially in regards to Marvel, Roy Thomas is right beside him. So what's that project particularly you're working on?
Well, the project is interesting. It's still in development, but we're working, you know, Roy has given his enthusiastic seal of approval. And so we're still getting our ducks in a row, but it's we've done some preliminary shooting. It's a feature film documentary. We've done some preliminary shooting. We did it last year, well before this pandemic started, and the pandemic has definitely thrown our schedule off as far as getting the actual shooting going. And also our fundraising has been delayed. We would have had a fundraiser out by now, but that has been delayed as well. We're still trying to sort through all that. But what we've got in mind is a feature film documentary, on Roy. And Roy has a very special place in comic book history. And just to kind of give you a teaser on the kind of direction we're going in, Roy Roy has a very interesting life in comics by itself. It's interesting to examine the things he was involved in as Stan's right-hand man. In the Silver Age, he was there when all the big things were happening. He was there when all the big personalities were coming in and out of the office at the height of their careers. Stan Lee, Steve Ditko, Jack Kirby. And Roy was also creating and expanding Marvel, incredibly with the things he was doing in the Avengers. He was reviving the Vision. He created Ultron. He helped bring in a sort of a whole new type of storytelling with Conan, adapting Robert E. Howard pulps. He was the first. A lot of people say Stan was the first editor-in-chief of Marvel, but technically Roy was the first editor-in-chief of Marvel, because that title wasn't created until Roy was given the job to replace Stan. Before that, it was just Stan was just like chief editor or editor. But they called the title editor-in-chief, and that was Roy was the first one to hold that title. And Roy's significance to Marvel and to comics in general is pretty huge. The characters he had a hand in creating are responsible for billions of dollars at the box office. The Avengers, Stan Lee and Jack Kirby assembled the Avengers, but I think Roy Thomas created the Avengers. The word create, he made the Avengers what we know them to be today. And so that's all sort of a preamble to what I really want to talk about, which is who Roy is. Roy represents, a lot of people take this word as a pejorative, but I don't. Roy represents the nerd who triumphs in the end. He's the guy who came in, who was part of that first generation, and certainly the most key creator of that first generation of creators in the 60s and 70s, who were reared on the medium of comics. Everybody before him, whether it was Stan or Bill Everett or Carl Burgos or Jack Kirby or Joe Simon, they were all artists first. They weren't comic book artists. They were illustrators and artists, and they may have created the comic book art form, but they had a whole life, and they had a whole mindset that existed outside of the art form of comic books. It was little minds of mush like Roy Thomas that ingested all these comic books and came to love them and treat them as like the sort of Rosetta Stone of their pop culture experience. It's like, they understood the continuity of what all these heroes were doing in their respective titles and how it related to other areas of pop culture in a way that Stan Lee couldn't possibly know. Stan was busy getting books out on time. Right. Stan was busy, Jack Kirby and Joe Simon were busy putting food on the table for their families, drawing these books. And while they obviously, they were geniuses, it was people like Roy that when they came into comics had a whole lexicon in their mind of what these guys were doing. And Stan had to be reminded of all these things he had done that he didn't even remember, but Roy did, And so you see characters like the Vision, that's Roy didn't create the Vision. Jack Kirby and Joe Simon created the Vision, but Roy pulled him out from the dustbin and polished him up and made him vital and new for a new generation of fans because he was a fan and because he saw the value in that character and he loved that character. He loved it in a way that only a fan can love it. And Roy's obsessive, he was a fan, writing all these fanzines, alter ego, you know, going to the first fan gatherings and assembling these fan gatherings with people, writing letters to fellow fans from across the world, you know, and then going to the earliest comic book conventions. They weren't, you know, they weren't even called Comic Cons back then, you know. Roy was doing all that before he took his first job in comics. And so to me, Roy represents that sort of vanguard of our pop culture that was reared on that culture.
Right.
And I think that's a nuance that to me is very interesting to explore. And so, you know, Roy's personality, who he is, where he came from, his, you know, every documentary has the humble beginnings part. And Roy has some wonderful humble beginnings in small town Missouri. And we've explored some of that. What made him tick as a creator when he was Stan's right hand man, and when he was handed the keys to Marvel's publishing, and all the things he did with Conan and with Star Wars, things that were so important in pop culture history. There's some interesting threads that run through Roy. That for instance, Arnold Schwarzenegger probably would not be the pop culture giant that he is now unless Roy had revived Conan the Barbarian in the substantive way that he did at Marvel. Yeah. You know, that was the perfect vehicle for someone like Arnold Schwarzenegger. It was the perfect timing for Arnold to meet the character he was born to play. But it's very doubtful that if, you know, the paperback novels had come and gone in popularity, you know, but the comic books are an enduring medium. Everybody keeps saying, you go through history and you've got all these creators who are always worried that next year is going to be the last year that comics are going to be viable. They're just going to go away. Yeah. And comics have endured since 1938, 39. They've never gone anywhere and they're never going anywhere. They're here to stay. And so, the significance of Conan the Barbarian as a comic book character is huge because it's a nexus point between, like, the pulp fiction of the 30s, the 20s and 30s with Robert E. Howard, and someone like Arnold Schwarzenegger, who is a, you know, a pop culture milestone. Roy Thomas is that nexus point. He sort of brings all these threads together. And it's just kind of neat to sort of examine these things in a historical way.
Yeah.
People like Roy and these kind of nerdy, obsessive, hyper-detailed fans that come in and have an effect on the art that they love. And that's sort of an interesting story to tell.
Yeah, very.
And so that's what...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, that's I was just going to sum up and say that's kind of the story, the dynamic we want to tell. We want to tell people all about who Roy is and what he's done in comics. And we also want to kind of draw out his place, in, you know, in the world, so you can sort of identify with him. People who don't even, maybe not even into comics,
yeah,
can look at someone like Roy and sort of understand where they relate to him.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I know about the history of Roy Thomas and you know how he was passed the baton in many ways and ushered in, like you said, that first wave of some of my favorite creators were the ones that came in with him simply because they were the fans that
right.
wanted to be comic book writers instead of looking at being a comic book creator as being in the slums. These kids like Len Wein and Marv Wolfman and Denny O'Neill and Jerry Conway, they were all guys who were proud to be comic book writers. Like they wore that, you know, as a badge of honor. And Roy was their captain. In a lot of ways,
yep.
He was there, that guy who opened the doors. And when you think about it, if Stan and Jack and all of those guys at Marvel who were creating the stuff to keep it being printed and published, they created, you know, the universe. But I guess it can be said that Roy created the culture in a lot of ways.
Yes, I think that's an excellent observation. Yeah,
like,
for sure.
People like him, and I think maybe after him, a Paul Levitz, who were so immersed in fandom that fandom exists the way it does because behind the scenes, these guys were doing all of that work to build that culture and make it something viable that people were happy to be a part of and to express their love for it. And I guess he's kind of, I don't know if this is a correct analogy, but he's almost like the Rick Jones of Marvel, where he's a connected to everything.
Yeah, yeah, that's interesting. I'll have to ask him about that. Yeah, Rick Jones is everywhere, kind of like the Woody Allen film Zelig. Yeah. Sort of like whenever there's an important moment in history, Zelig is sort of in the background somewhere, you know. But in comics, Roy just knew how to synthesize things. He knew the value in a character like the Vision, or, you know, when he made the Invaders, he saw the value in recontextualizing the World War II era for a new generation of readers. And, you know, and he did sort of a similar thing with DC with All-Star Squadron, which was one of my favorite DC comics in the early 80s. I was a big New Teen Titans fan, and All-Star Squadron and Legion of Superheroes. Those are my DC titles, and Firestorm. Can't leave out Firestorm. Roy, you know, and then Roy to be able to turn Conan into something like he did, and then later Star Wars, right. You know,
right.
Just Roy had a knack for seeing the value in things. And he was such a great sounding board for Stan, because Roy could talk Stan into things that Stan might not have wanted to do instinctively, you know. Roy was really the perfect foil for Stan in those from 1965 to 1971 was when Stan was still active as sort of editor and writer. Those years were really good for that partnership.
Yeah. And it's interesting too, like, as you mentioned, him being in that seat of editor in chief for a bit, for him to also have the foresight in a way to see the, I guess, the vision of what somebody like a Jim Starlin would do, where at the time it was ahead of its time, it was somewhat avant-garde, but now you look back at that stuff that he let him take over, in essence, characters that he created, and what became of just those decisions to say, let Starlin be Starlin.
Right.
And
that's a really good insight, and I agree completely, especially since as someone who has edited Roy's writing, I can tell you from personal experience, Roy will fight for his writing. He likes when he turns in his manuscript, he knows it's not perfect, but he doesn't want much done to it beyond, you know, correcting for obvious typos and grammars and fact checks. But he doesn't want you going in and fussing with the way he words things and the way he projects his personality in his text. Hmm. Roy, you can feel Roy. And his essays, they're not generic. You can feel Roy Thomas when you read those things.
Right.
He's got little twists of phrases, and the way he sometimes outlines his thoughts are very Roy.
Right.
And so, to that end, I think he extended that feeling to his when he was editor in chief to his creators. And so, when he had someone like Jim Starlin come in. And you realize very quickly what a monumental talent someone like Starlin is. If you're Roy Thomas, you let him do his thing, you know. And I think Roy did that more often than not with his, you know. And that's not always a surefire way of success,
but
you do allow people like Jim Starlin to come in and create milestone comics,
right?
And new ways of telling stories. Deep of the times, storytelling. You know, it's so definitely.
Yeah, and he falls in, like, I feel like he's somewhat of the forefather too in regards to that nerdy attention to detail, appreciating what's been the tracks that have been laid in the same vein the way a Kurt Busiek did, and in the way somebody like a Mark Waid or even a Jeff Johns, like these guys really love. the characters, and it comes through in their writing. And when the writer really loves the history of these characters and who's worked on them before, there's something, usually I find, something magical that comes out of it. It may be to a fault, they love them too much, but I find that all of those guys have that sort of appreciation the way Roy did for Stan's work. So it comes in handy, I think. You need guys like that.
Right. You know, it can sometimes go too far in the sense of, like, one complaint about that could be that continuity can be taken too far.
Right.
You know, when you have to have a, you know, a dictionary and an encyclopedia to understand a new comic book, that's sort of what, you know, Joe Quesada and Jimmy Palmiotti, when they came in to take over Marvel in the early 2000s, were the antithesis of that. They did not want that. And so, but that was a very refreshing swing of the pendulum when they came in and did that. But there's, you know, but there is, continuity is wonderful. And for long time, hardcore obsessive readers like you and me, it can be very, very wonderful. And also very, you know, very creative, because you're finding, old story threads and old character moments that you can exploit to sort of bring new life to them and tell a new story that can link back to an older one. And it just is more epic. It's got this epic connectivity to it. And I will tell you that if it's one thing that is sort of the defining characteristic of these mega billion-dollar Marvel Cinematic Universe in movies and in Netflix or what have you, it's the connective tissue element.
Absolutely.
Okay? It's the continuity element.
Absolutely.
That's the thing that is the nuclear powered fuel for this box office. Okay?
Absolutely.
And the old style of, like, you know, we're going to give you one story and, you know, and then in the next issue, there's going to be no reference to the prior story. You know, it's just going to be a brand new story, self-contained every issue. You know, that is not what fans are responding to right now. Normal, average, everyday people love continuity. They love it.
They love
sitting down. There are normal, everyday Americans or people around the world that sit down and watch every Marvel movie in a row. Isn't that crazy? Isn't that nuts? It's like 25 of them.
It is, but it makes perfect sense. It makes perfect sense.
That's what you and I used to do in our caves of solitude, dude, when we were reading our comic books. You know, and now everybody's doing it in their own way, in their own medium of choice. They are reliving the same saga of Marvel or of DC or what have you that we did. Yeah. And it's people like Roy that are at the center of understanding that. They're at the center of understanding what that is.
Yeah.
Because comics weren't always that way.
No.
You know, and Roy came along and said, listen, this is an important ethos of comic book storytelling. Let's make sure that we do this right. And of course Stan had been doing it before Roy came along. But what Roy did was came in and really helped him develop it even more. So anyway.
Absolutely. Well, I'm really looking forward to when this is completed. You've really whet my appetite for it and really given me a new appreciation for Roy Thomas as a creator. I mean, I did before, but it really kind of put things into perspective when you lay things out a certain way and see the full scope of what it was that they contributed. So that's going to be cool. Where can people reach you if they want to follow you with your work, whether it's some of the books that you've worked on, your website? Just plug those again for us.
Yeah, well, come to collectededitions.com. There's also a forum. It's easily linked to from the website. And I am going to be starting a Facebook page for Collected Editions pretty soon, probably pretty soon. So maybe, you know, check. I'll have a link on the website, obviously, when it's up. But if people are on Facebook, they're more than welcome to come join that page when I have it up. And I'm going to start a Gormu. I have my regular civilian account, but I'm going to start a Gormu account for my superhero alter ego. So anybody listening to this is welcome to look for that in the coming days and send me a friend request. And if you're a friend of the Cave of Solitude or Comics Against podcast,
shout out to Adam.
You're a friend of mine, so bring it on.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for your time. I got a bunch of other things that we could talk about, but I hope I can get you back on the show for another episode
where
we can dig into some more nerdy stuff. This has been great.
Yeah, absolutely. That'd be great. That'd be great.
Thank you, everybody, for tuning in for episode 199. 200 is right around the corner. Please stay tuned for that. Rate and review us on iTunes or whatever your podcast platform is. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram. Thank you once again for listening. This is Eric Anthony of the Cave of Solitude. Take care and be safe, everybody.